You're listening to Rendezvous with a Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, where readers and writers meet, and
story is everything.
We're your hosts tonight, Jim and Bobby Bell.
And we're so happy that you're with us. That music given to us to use courtesy of Alex Dormont and the Hot Texas Swing Band opens and closes every show. And you know what, Jim?
What?
Alex is going to be with us on April 11th. He's going to be our featured guest. Hot Texas Swing Band has just released a brand new album called Gotta Move, and we're so excited. We're going to have him right here with us.
It'll be fun to have him on. Right.
But who do we have on tonight?
Our friend and special author, E. Joe Brown.
Hey.
Welcome.
E. Joe Brown is his official name if you're wanting to follow him or look him up. But to us, he's just Joe.
You betcha. How are you?
We're good. How are you?
Well, if I was any better, I couldn't stand it.
We were all together for the Super Bowl. Yeah. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was.
Yes, that was a lot of fun. And
that was quite
Joe's wife, Linda, always provides the best snacks. You want to go over to their house for good company and really good snacks. So
a lot of people will show up at his place.
Well, Joe, we are delighted to have you coming back to visit with us a second time. Joe was with us back in, I want to say, October of 2022. And Jim, do you have a little bio?
We have a little bio.
Yeah.
Folks, I need to catch up with Joe here. E. Joe Brown writes historical fiction, memoirs, and short stories. He retired from his U.S. Air Force military and civil service careers in 2010. As a senior analyst advising the Major General commanding the United States Air Force Flight Test Center. He is Vice President of Southwest Writers, a member of Western Writers of America, Military Writers Society of America, and several other nonprofit organizations. All right, Joe.
Wow, I'm tired.
No, you're retired.
He's getting started.
So, Joe, the last time you were with us, we talked about this book, A Cowboy's Destiny, and it was the first book in a saga series. Mm-hmm. And then last month, congratulations, you just released the second, which is called A Cowboy's Fortune. So why don't you tell us, why don't you tell us a little bit about the series that you envision and what's happened since we saw you the last time?
Well, okay. The series is set 100 years ago, first off. You know, starts actually, book one for a brief period is around 1913 to 1517, but it really begins to unfold in 1917. And the saga will last well through at least the roaring 20s. It's about a young cowboy who's got a dream. He wants to be a top hand, a top ranch hand at the Miller's 101 Ranch in northern Oklahoma. That actually existed 100 years ago. And the 101 was very famous for being just a massive 110,000 acre ranch. Basically, its own town. It had its own post office, its own restaurant, cafe, if you will, hotel, and then about a dozen businesses on top of it being a cattle ranch. One of those businesses was oil. And during book one, Charlie Kelly, my protagonist, who was inspired by my maternal grandfather, Clarence Kelly. He gets to the 101 and in book one becomes a hand there. And I won't give away the entire story because if someone hasn't bought book one, they really need to. I'm teasing. Actually, though, I would love it if they would. During book one, Charlie matures. He meets a young lady who, by the end of the book, becomes his bride. And I'll share that. That is part of the story in book one. Charlie reaching his goal in life to be a hand at the top, and it becomes a top hand at the 101. Then book two, takes the story and takes you through the first year or so of Charlie and Susan as a couple. That has its own set of conflicts and successes, because it is a book that has maybe less conflict. It has conflict for sure. And matter of fact, a very important scene, climactic scene, but it really talks equally about the successes and so forth that the young couple shares in their first year. So, and since I was on the show, book one has been a bestseller on two separate occasions, and it was a finalist in the Arizona New Mexico Book Awards. And so I'm very, very thrilled about the success the book has had. Mm-hmm. And hopefully we'll see that with book two.
In book one, we can see on the title, there is a horse. And we can see very softly, subtly in the background, an image that has to do with oil. Mm-hmm. But in book two, there is a very, very clearly oil mm-hmm. is going to take over for the horse in terms of some of their attention. Horse is still part of their story. And of course, and on the back, we have an automobile. So it's also a reminder that they're written about something 100 years ago, but this is not that old Wild West. There's some wildness to some of what goes on, but you are definitely writing a more more modern kind of story.
And my grandfather's story. Now you picture me as, like, let's say, an 8-year-old, 9-year-old, 10-year-old kid, still sitting on my granddaddy's lap, or sitting out under a tree in his front yard with a history book and so forth, and him sharing his stories from the 101, as well as us discussing the history of Oklahoma at the mm-hmm. time. I'm a native Oklahoman, born and raised there, and the 101 Ranch, of course, is in northern Oklahoma. And I have been to the site. I have developed an acquaintance, actually, I would have to say a friendship, with Joe Glazer, who is the historian for the 101 Ranch mm-hmm. and is on the board of directors of the 101 Ranch Old Timers Association, which I'm a proud member. That's another nonprofit that I really have all kinds of time to support.
I know you have questions, Jim.
You know, Cowboy's Destiny. When did you start writing that book, Joe?
Began it in 2019, late 2019, and the bulk of the book. The bulk of what I have accomplished, I accomplished in 2020. Now I've spent a lot of time since then on book one, revising it before it was published in 2022. And then I continued to revise, you know, some of that work that was done to create book two. And now I am working on book three. That I hope to be able to see that published within the next year to 15 months or so, maybe 18, but anyway.
You just came back from a successful book tour. for book two. And book one, you had a couple of very successful tours, but you just came back in January, shortly after this was released. Any good tips on how to prepare for a book tour?
Well, yes, I actually do. The tour in Oklahoma is where I went for this recent one, and I launched. It's called a book launch, and most folks that are watching this and listening will be very familiar with that term. I launched the book in Cushing, Oklahoma, my hometown, where I graduated high school, and so forth. And the climactic scene in book two happens in Cushing, Oklahoma, 100 years ago, but the city existed then and was an oil town, a thriving oil town, 100 years ago. And so since Kelly Oil comes into, you know, play in book two, the dream was there in book one and so forth, but it actually came into existence and began to thrive in book two. But things to think about when you want to create a book tour and launch a book. I would say the biggest thing is think about locations that are in the book. You can build a tour around those locations. Or if you have a particular close relationship with a city or individuals and so forth in places, you can build on that. But I will tell you, that's not all that you look at. I did a what I would call a pretty big tour, a 3-week tour in September, October for book one. And Linda and I drove through 13 states. Now, we only had 8 stops, but you have to get to these places. So you drive through some states and maybe they don't have a signing. But that was very successful because I created new relationships. Mm-hmm. But as you begin to plan, say, your first book tour or your next book tour, and whatever the case is, I would be thinking about connectivity to what you've written or to you as the author, and because that can be extremely useful.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We're going to take a very short break. We want all of our listeners and our watchers to find out where they can get one of the places they can get E. Joe Brown's books, as well as all of the books of our guests here on Rendezvous with a Writer. And when we come back, we're going to actually get into more detail about A Cowboy's Fortune. We'll be right back. One on Out West Shops, a bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu. Choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer, our special guest, E. Joe Brown. We're talking about his books. We talked a little bit about Cowboy's Destiny. We're going to talk about more about Cowboy's Fortune, part of the Kelly Can Saga series. It's kind of exciting, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we got a couple of characters in there, and you said we got Charlie Kelly and Susan Kramer Kelly, because she becomes his wife. Mm-hmm. And Charlie's modeled a little bit after your grandfather. Tell us a little bit about Charlie. What kind of guy is he?
Mm-hmm. Well, Charlie is in his early 20s, and he's a pure cowboy in his culture and in his way of looking at life. He's 6'4", 6'5", so he's a big guy. Not fat, not like 300 or 400 pounds, but a big dude. As a matter of fact, one of the scenes in book one, I described that Charlie, as he walks down this street in Perkins, Oklahoma, people step aside. And yet he's one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. But you really, just like my granddad was a big man. He was 6'4", and now he was born in 1898. So I'm creating Charlie like him. My granddad was a big man for his era. I mean, guys weren't, there weren't very many guys 6'4", 100 years ago. Like the
sounds like a John Wayne character.
Well, yeah. But I patterned Charlie after him in this way.
Yeah.
He's basically a good guy and easy to get along with and so forth. But you don't want to mess with him because that's not going to work out well for you. But he's a cowboy. Means his words is bond. His handshake is as good as a contract, and he'll have his buddies back. Those kinds of things, and that's Charlie. That's the character that I've built, and that philosophy will be throughout the saga. Now he'll mature and he'll learn new things and all of that, but he'll be the fundamental guy that started in book one. Just with a few more years on him.
Well, how about Susan? Now, Susan comes from a little different background than Charlie.
She would be like almost opposite.
He marries up.
and the beautiful part about it, he meets her and they fall in love and all of that in book one. But Charlie does not know her as the heiress of a fortune that she is. Now, that doesn't mean that he didn't think that she had money, but because he knew she had more than he did. And but that was a pretty low bar. but Susan is the only child of the richest man west of the Mississippi. His name is Walter Kramer. I patterned Walter after a gentleman that, and he lives in Kansas City. And there was a guy 100 years ago named William Kemper, who became a huge banker. As a matter of fact, there's Kemper Arena and Kemper this and Kemper that still to this day in Kansas City. And so I modeled him. Now, William Kemper he was a huge banker and he had some other interests as well. But Walter not only is a banker or has a banking system, but he has a railroad and he's got a construction company and he owns a chain of retail stores back then. And this was about the time that a thing called a department store came into existence, and I kind of play on the fact that he was one of the early department store people. And one of Walter's friends happened to be J.C. Penney. Mm-hmm. Oh, I wonder where I heard about him, Jim. That's an inside joke, folks. There was a day, right, Jim?
You know, yeah, we have some connections there,
You know, they're kind of, the two of them, Joey and Susan, are kind of simpatico, but it's kind of interesting. They both have strong goals, and they both seem to be very business-minded. And their ideas kind of fall into place with each other, so...
Well, that is extremely accurate. She is a graduate of Vassar with a degree in economics, and she and her first husband, this is a spoiler alert here, Susan, when they met, was married, but her husband passes in a tragic fire in their store. They are business people. in the small town in Oklahoma that Charlie meets them. But Charlie shows some business savvy working for them for a short period of time. And then up at the 101, well, he becomes a cowboy, definitely, but it's learned that he can kind of take charge and lead people, and it's learned that he's a high school graduate, and back then a high school graduate was like a college graduate today. So he gained a lot of respect for his education, and he began to learn the oil business helping out the Miller brothers who owned the 101, especially George Miller, of course.
Mm-hmm. But so anyway. Joe, let's talk about oil, because obviously, especially in this book, it really becomes a character. It's almost like a character in the book. And there are people trying to get it. There are people bidding for it. There are people drilling for it. There's lots of action around oil. Yes. And for some of our readers, unless you already had an interest in oil, we maybe only know about oil through Dallas or, some show where we really don't have very, very good knowledge.
Funny you should say that. My publisher, as he's learned the plans I have for the storyline, he says, "Oh my goodness, Joe." He says, "That's a blend of that movie Lonesome Dove, Pure Cowboy, and that TV show Dallas."
And a little movie of Giant thrown in there, probably.
A little Giant thrown in. I could agree with
that. A little Giant,
yeah. Yeah, a little bit of Giant, yeah. But, yes, oil in Oklahoma during this era exploded. As a matter of fact, there was a point in time that my hometown was called the oil capital of the world.
Cushing. We're talking about Cushing again. Cushing.
Right. Yes. And it's still to this very day, the pipeline crossroads of the world. People may not recall this, but during the Obama administration, Obama went to Cushing. Was there because of what it is, the pipeline crossroads of the world. Then Tulsa became even bigger than Cushing, and then Houston, I guess, would probably be considered the oil capital of the world now. Oil was huge 100 years ago, and it still is. There's still just oil all over the place. Men that were in the oil business set up offices in Tulsa and Cushing, but a lot of them in Tulsa. I chose to go this route just so I would be following a very natural progression. There was a lot of cattlemen that began to lease out their land. They typically held on to it, so they could run their cattle. But you started seeing oil derricks on ranches, and on 101 there was a bunch of oil derricks.
Mineral rights. I know you have a question.
Yeah, Joe, you actually have a little background here. You kind of studied petroleum engineering, right, when you were in college?
Well, yes, I ended up doing engineering for the Air Force out of Edwards Air Force Base. Mostly electronic, because that's where I ended up. But I started my college education at the at Oklahoma State University in the College of Engineering, and studying petroleum engineering.
Right.
And after a couple of years, I decided I didn't want to be a petroleum engineer. Probably not necessarily the best decision I ever made. Well, it turned out okay.
Well, I think it turned out okay.
That's all right.
Well, if you would, and for readers out there, Joe, as the author, does help us to understand. He doesn't just assume that we know the oil business. And as Charlie is learning it, we're learning it. And actually, Susan, to a degree, too, are learning it. And you have us You put Charlie and Susan right in the middle of names that we all know, even though we may not know a lot about them. We've got Sinclair.
Yeah,
and Harry's we have Getty. And so tell us, it's very interesting you introduce these characters. We get meals with them. We're in bidding wars with them. We mm-hmm. hang around with them. Tell us a little bit about creating, bringing these characters in and how you researched them and how you connected them into the story.
Well, I did a lot of research as far as what was going on at the time, who the movers and shakers were, and who was the movers and shakers in the oil industry. And yes, Harry Sinclair of Sinclair Oil and SNAP, a lot of what he owned it that was Marlin, well, and E.W. Marlin is part of this too. Harry Sinclair was critical to some things that are going to happen. J. Paul Getty was in his 20s, just like my characters.
And we liked him. We liked him.
He's a character. He's got a reputation.
I know.
So I played on that. I mean, he didn't miss how beautiful Susan is and her feminine charms. But he's also a phenomenal businessman. As a matter of fact, later on in life, J. Paul Getty's the richest man in the world in his era.
And he goes to California. True. He travels. Yeah. He goes looking for oil in California too, right, Joe? Is that in like book three or four?
Yes, he does. In his life, he had already spent some time in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And of course, his dad, George Getty, made his fortune right there north of Tulsa, Oklahoma, in the oil business. Mm. So Paul comes in and he's there, and he's there during the era that we're talking about, during that time frame. And the oil men, a lot of them, had suites or rooms for sure in a hotel that doesn't exist now, but it was there then, and it was glamorous, called the Hotel Tulsa. There was actually floors designated as suites for the guys that were pretty much permanently there. And million-dollar deals, just like they were done on, I hope we talk about the Osage stuff, but there was a tree there, and we'll talk about it, that a lot of million-dollar deals were done. Well, there were a lot of million-dollar deals done in the lobby of the Hotel Tulsa. So Charlie and Susan go there and coincidentally meet these guys and ended up having dinner with them. And Harry Sinclair knew Susan's dad, so that was an easy transition. As a matter of fact, in book one and two, Walter, before he while he's still part of the story, he admits that, hey, I've got a buddy named Harry Sinclair, and he and I've been talking. Charlie, I'm excited that you're helping out at the 101 in the oil business because I've been looking at it. Mm-hmm. So all of this just made for a good transition into the oil business, and Kelly Oil is formed, and Kelly Oil basically has opportunities to expand in book two, and Harry Sinclair plays a role in that. As a matter of fact, I've mentioned a couple of times that Charlie was a dreamer.
Yep.
Well, he has dreams about what he wants to do with Kelly Oil, and the person that he admires is Harry Sinclair, because Harry, in creating Sinclair Oil, he went everything from the exploring and finding the oil and drilling and, you know, getting it out of the ground to refining it, to distributing it, to selling gas stations. I mean, he was the first guy that kind of did it end to end. Charlie admired that.
Well, and they both totally get that concept. They're a little bit like songwriter that understands. I write it, I publish it, I sing it, and if you use any part of it, I'm going to make money. And it's sort of like they understand.
Yes.
Every piece of it. If you own the refinery, you take care of your own oil, and you may be able to help others. If you have the trucks, if you have the quarry to get the cement. Mm-hmm. I mean, they are big vision thinkers.
Yes.
And
yes.
Supportive of each other as they get the idea. You know, they just go, okay, let's go do that. Yeah, you want to do that story? Yeah, you go do that. I'm going to do this over here. And then we're going to have dinner and we're going to catch up with.
Exactly. And I will tell you, Charlie already knew this, and he and his beautiful bride were already a great team because mm-hmm. she had the classic education and she had learned a lot from her daddy. So she had her own set of mm-hmm. experiences and skills, but she admired in Charlie the fact that he could envision things mm-hmm. and see things.
Yep, oh, mm-hmm.
I never thought of that, Charlie. That's right. Yeah.
Right. And then immediately, because she's learned so much from her dad, but immediately she's already thinking about, okay, we'll get the money. Okay, I've got some over here and some over there, and we're going to move that around, and I can mm-hmm. pull it from here. And how much do you need? And okay, let me call Uncle Kurt.
Exactly. Yeah.
Bang, done.
You have described how someone with the wealth thinks.
Yeah.
They do think about, okay,
a little different.
I can take money from here. I'm making money, but I can make more over here. Okay, I need to move it up. You know, it's great.
Yeah.
And I will tell you that I love that part of the story, you know, where people kind of think outside the box sometimes. And again, in book two, in The Fortune, what we're focusing on is the cowboy and his bride, but it's the cowboy starting to create a fortune,
mm-hmm.
you know.
You have a question.
Yeah, just before we go to the break.
Yeah. Yeah, Jim has a question, and then we're going to take a break.
You created these great these characters who dream and can plan and can do. Did you have total control on them, or did they kind of do a few things on their own that you didn't expect?
Okay. I will tell you, I could use something in book two, but let me, because it's just completely destroys that idea that you know everything going on. Susan didn't exist when I started the story.
Okay.
Susan didn't exist when I started the story.
Mm-hmm.
So
we did it. Yeah.
So the character leads you down the path, and you just need to listen.
Yeah, she's quite a woman, you know.
She's an amazing. They're an amazing team. Yeah. We're gonna take a quick break, and when we come back, and we thank our sponsor at West Shop, and when we come back, we're going to get more into the oil business of leasing and a little bit about how that connects to this story. And we're going to hear where the $1 million elm is located. And so stay tuned. We'll be right back with E. Joe Brown.
Yeah.
American West, the truth and the myth. We're purveyors of fine Western goods. We scout for unique and distinctive apparel, accessories, home decor, and general merchandise that are a reflection of the Western style. We hunt for unique artisans and craftsmen who are inspired to create decorative art you can wear based on their own love for the story of the West. We round it up and bring it to you. Check out OutWestShop.com when you need anything Western.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Running with the Writer. Special guest, E. Joe Brown. Just getting into the oil business here with both feet.
Yeah. Right.
Now, I was going to say, Charlie really starts getting involved when he buys some of these leases in what they call, the Burbank plots, the Burbank ground.
Burbank?
Yeah.
Castle?
Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. Well, if you haven't been to Burbank, Oklahoma, my goodness, that's a... Well, I tell you what, if you blink, you miss it, but that's okay.
Well, go ahead.
I go say, but when you read, when I first read Burbank, you know, well, being from California to some degree, you know, it's like, that's all you can think about in L.A. Burbank, Oklahoma.
Yeah. So well, in chapter 11, there's an auction. It's June 1919.
Yep.
And there is an action that occurs that really puts Kelly Oil on the map at this auction.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not really a spoiler alert. It's an important piece that project, you know, takes the story forward. But what happens at that auction, and where does that auction happen?
All right. The auction is real. Okay. It was really happening at the time. And the Osage Nation, the nation of Native Americans, they're, if you will, reservation as we think of it today, was Osage County in Oklahoma now, okay? And in the town of Pawhuska, Oklahoma. And for those of you ladies that maybe on Saturday morning are watching the Food Network, Bree Drummond, the pioneer woman.
I mean,
Bree, what I say, Bree? I'm sorry, my wife is here. She corrected me. See, Bree Drummond. She and she's known as the pioneer woman, and she has a show on the Food Network. But she's from Pawhuska, so it's in the northern part of Oklahoma, and in that town, there's a place called Agency Hill, and it is a hill. I mean, you drive up it. I've been there. I've been to the location that's in the book more than once. But on Agency Hill was the county courthouse and also the headquarters, if you will, of the Osage Nation. And there was a tree there. It is no longer there. Something happened and it had to be taken down, but there's a monument where it was. But I've seen pictures from back then. That tree was as big as the three-story building that it was next to. And under that tree, they would erect a podium, if you will, a raised place where the auctioneer could auction off the mineral rights and in some cases the land as well, and people may not understand that. So let me share with them that oil companies or energy companies, because natural gas and whatever, you know, energy companies oftentimes don't own the surface, the land as the surface. It could be a cattle ranch, or it could be a farm, or it could be just whatever, the Bureau of Land Management land. But energy companies like today, Exxon or Chevron or whatever, would go in and they could lease the rights to the minerals, to include oil, under the surface.
Yeah.
And so if you ever hear of the term oil lease or oil field or all of those things, that is more than likely the energy company, the oil company doesn't own the land, but they own the rights to go see if they can find oil or natural gas or whatever. And so on Agency Hill, starting in about 1916, I think it was, they began to auction off Osage land. And of course, in the movie, The Killers of the Flower Moon, the book and the movie, that is a major portion. I've got that. I've got that right over here. but there, all of this was happening coincidentally. Now, The Killers of the Flower Moon, that focuses mostly into the 20s. But what led to that started actually in 1916. Charlie has a partner called Hank Thomas. He worked for E.W. Marlin in the storyline and was considered one of the premier men in Oklahoma who could find oil. And there were people like that. Tom Slick is the wildcatter individual guy that found the oil field in Cushing Drumright area that created a huge boom, 1914 mm-hmm. to 1918 and so forth. But anyway, on Agency Hill, there was an auction frequently. And Hank comes to Charlie and says, hey, there's some land that's going to be coming up for auction that we want. We want mm-hmm. the rights to that land. And so he takes Charlie there, and they go to the auction. And at the auction, they see Frank Phillips of Phillips Oil, Phillips 66 Oil Stations. They see Harry Sinclair and Getty's there, and William Skelly of Skelly Oil is there, and so forth. And so I remember in the book, I have Hank say something to the effect of, well, that's our competition there, mm-hmm. Charlie. <Yeah. laughs> How much money did you bring? kind of thing. But as it turns out, in that auction scene, a person that was a bad guy,
yep.
book one, rears his ugly head again in book two. he was a old man, not a big guy like Sinclair and so forth. But he was an old man in his own way, and it turns out that Charlie ends up bidding for the land they wanted most, which is over around Burbank. And by the way, that's an area that became huge in the time frame we're talking about now. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I'm trying to be at least reasonably close.
Sure. You know?
But it is a work of fiction, but you know, where it can be fact is not a bad thing. he outbids this guy, and as the guy leaves the site, basically gives Charlie a shoulder that kind of not necessary, and lets him know that he's going to pay for this.
Yep.
And later in the book.
Well, you have to read the book.
Yeah.
Because you also, you know, we really like Hank. He's a lot of fun. Every scene Hank is in is just delightful. Well, and
Hank is amazing to me.
He's got a nose.
He's like... a guy with a sixth sense, yeah. You know.
It's, absolutely, and there were guys like that, and still to this day, there's people like that.
Sure.
Although the technology of finding oil has certainly makes it harder to miss, but back then there were guys just like Hank. I didn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, I made him up, but I made him up from a. Yeah, collection sure. of yeah, people yeah. like that,
sure.
And it's Hank and Getty that get Charlie and Susan out to California,
yeah.
And that's one of the things about this book that I really want to emphasize. Book two is a book of transition.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
There's some conflict and so forth in it, but most of what my goal was in book two was to create the foundation of a story of them as a couple, okay. and where they're heading. And they will end up out in California, and later on they're going to have to visit Texas, and they're going to end up having to visit the East Coast. There's some interesting things. And while they're in California, they're going to get an opportunity to expand their banking business. So, I mean, you know, and expand their farming and ranching business. So, you know, it's all good.
are they going to look upward? Are we going to have aviation make its, are we going to have aviation appear in the story?
It's set up, and I absolutely intend for Charlie to do some joint venture work in aviation and radio with Bill Skelly of Skelly Oil. Bill Skelly ended up doing some big things in the start of the fledgling aviation world and radio.
Yeah, Yeah.
As a matter of fact, Scully's station that he built ended up being the station that Bob Wills and his brother Johnny Lee Wills were on in Oklahoma for years.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, I sat as a kid listening to "Aha, Take It Away."
Joe, there's a lot of characters in these in this book, and lots of interaction, lots of dialogue, and mm-hmm. sometimes around a dinner table, and sometimes you know, talking business and all. Did you find writing dialogue at all? You have many different voices and different kinds of characters. Did you have challenges finding Getty's voice versus Hank's voice versus, you know, Susan's voice?
Not as actually, I see a movie in my head as I'm going through. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of picture certain things. I'll tell you a secret. Susan is basically Linda Carter of Wonder Woman.
Wonder Woman.
She always seems so smart and beautiful, of course, yeah. You know, and picturesque and all that kind of stuff. But her character when she was Wonder Woman, she just seemed smart, you know. And as I was thinking about who I should be visualizing in my movie, yeah. She came to mind. Now, maybe Susan's smarter than Linda Carter, but I'm just saying, you know, and so Linda Carter had a pattern of how she talked. Mm-hmm. And I try, you know, but Susan's got her own pattern. Yeah, but you're right. I the word usage and how they phrase things, hopefully people sound, the different characters sound somewhat different, you know.
Are you going to be anywhere that people could come out and meet you? Any place you're going to be coming up?
I really am. I'm going to be at Tombstone in Tucson for the booksellers thing in the early part of March. Mid-March, I'm back here in home, and I'll be at Treasure House Books in Old Town Plaza of here in Albuquerque. And then I have some other things that are maybes, but a couple of for sure things are in June. I'm going to be in Tulsa at the Western Writers of America Conference, and I probably will be doing some book signings around there because I have some groundwork laid. I hope that all comes to play. And then in July, I've been asked to come back to the Chisholm Trail Heritage Center and be part of their Day of the Cowboy.
Day of the Cowboy.
Excellent.
Fabulous.
Excellent.
And
I will be there in July. Oh, well, it's the last Saturday
in July. Right. Yeah. Right. Well, we really want to thank again, and Joe's going to stay with us. We are wrapping up the show. I'm looking at that clock on the wall. So we've had a wonderful time. We've been talking about a little bit about book one, A Cowboy's mm-hmm. Destiny. And then, of course, we have focused on book two,
Cowboy's Fortune.
And next week, we are pleased again to have another author coming back to visit with us. Next week, we have Martha Burns and a brand new book that launches very shortly called Across the Narrows. And Martha will be with us. She was with us a year ago with her first book, which was an award winner, The Blind Eye. So we're excited to have Martha, who is in the Santa Fe area, and she's doing a book signing in Santa Fe Sunday, March 4th. Yeah. We're thinking we ought to go up there. Anyway, yeah. If you you're watching tonight, this was episode 73. You can catch it on the podcast. Just go to any of your favorite streaming channels and search for Rendezvous with a Writer. We want to thank Sam Hassan and LA Talk Radio and Alex and the Hot Texas Swing Band for providing tonight's opening and closing music. And And you have a quote.
Well, we get, yeah, we got a couple.
Yeah, you have a quote.
This is a quote from Susan, actually. We've been talking about Susan. And Charlie and Susan were in a meeting here with all the oil guys. And she says, she stops and she says, you know, Charlie's genuine. He's not a game player, and he's willing to share the benefits of hard work. But those who share in the work, it creates a strong and long-lasting bond. And I had this quote I've known for a long time. This is from the great oil man, H.L. Hunt. You know, on achieving success, he says, decide what you want, decide what you will give up to get there, make a plan, work the plan.
Thank you all for being with us tonight.
And it's always a great day out west.
We'll see you down the trail. Keep reading.